Ladies and gentlemen, start your engines. It's time to get revved up for sports, sports, and guess what? More sports on the RPM Roundtable Podcast with Robin Clark, Paul McGaughy, and Mike Sesney.
Welcome to the RPM Roundtable Podcast. This is episode 5. It's Friday, March the 15th. I'm Paul. I'm here along with Robin and Mike. And just before we get into our topics for today, it occurred to me that we've never actually introduced ourselves to the audience. I know our friends listening know who we are and know what we do on a daily basis. So just quickly, we are students in the graduate sports journalism program at Centennial College in Toronto. Now we're back from actually a 2-week hiatus again. We have a good reason though. Last week we went on a class trip down to Tampa, Florida, and we got to take in some spring training camps, and I thought it would be fun if we could just chat a little bit about what we did down there. Mike, you want to kick it off?
Sure, yeah. We were visiting some of the minor league spring training camps. I know different groups did different things, but the majority of us all did Phillies and Blue Jays. I believe one group was able to take in the Baltimore Orioles major league camp. And we also spent some time covering a USF golf tournament and a USF and NC State women's tennis match. I think overall it was a great experience. We all got a number of good written pieces done. Actually, the three of us, I believe, all had some articles published.
Yep.
Myself, I had an article on Daniel Norris published on Sportsnet.ca, an article on a Philadelphia Phillies prospect, Larry Green, published in the Allentown Morning Call, and I have a third one I'm still working on that might go to Allentown, hopefully. Robin, I know you also got an article published in Allentown, I believe.
Yeah, in the same publication that you did on the Monday, the first article, actually. I interviewed a guy by the name of Roman Quinn, a 19-year-old shortstop in the Phillies organization. He was a second-round pick a couple of years ago, and just based on a little bit of digging that I did, I would be fairly surprised if he wasn't the opening day shortstop for the Phillies in 2015, just based on his progression as well as the contract situation of Jimmy Rollins. So that was really cool, and also getting published and seeing your name at the bottom of the article saying so-and-so is a freelance writer or special to whatever publication you were in. So that was really neat.
Just before you go on, so it's Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Yes.
That's the paper that you were in. And just explain the significance and the relationship between the Allentown newspaper and the Phillies organization.
Yeah, I believe their AAA club plays in Allentown.
Right.
Oh, so, they do?
Yeah.
Okay.
So a lot of fans of that team are going to see that article.
Right, yeah. No, it's really neat. Apparently they have somewhere in the vicinity of 90,000 to 95,000 subscribers to the actual paper, plus however many people get it online. So yeah, definitely a good experience. I was also just going to add another cool story. When I was at Jay's minor league camp, I was with someone else in the program, and we found our players, and we were taking some pictures of them just on one of the diamonds, and they were finishing up by just doing a drill that pitchers often do, where the hitting instructors smash balls at them from close range, and they basically act as a hockey goalie to try and stop them. And once you get a certain number, you're done for the day, so there's incentive for them not to just goof around. And when they were finished, a guy came over to us, started talking to us, and we had a really nice conversation just about baseball, life, whatever else. And when we mentioned we were from Toronto, he said that he had lived for a number of years in Montreal. And at the end of the conversation, the other person who I was with, Nadia from our class, she happened to remember to ask him his name. And he said, Tim. And as we were walking away, I realized, oh my God, a guy who's played in Montreal or who lived in Montreal is a baseball instructor. And I realized it was Tim Raines, who is one of the best baseball players I'm not going to say ever, but a really good baseball player who will likely be in the Hall of Fame in a few years. So that was really neat.
Yeah, he was on the ballot this
year.
Yeah, he was. Almost so, just missed it, I think.
Yeah. So that's a really, really neat thing that happened.
It was a great experience for all of us. We got some real-life journalism experience. We have been tweeting our articles and posting them on Facebook. Within the next couple of weeks, we're hoping to have our website up and running, and at that point, we'll be posting links to all of our stuff, and it'll be a lot easier to click on it and take a look at it. So we're going to move right in. We're going to keep with baseball, and we're going to continue our MLB preview. On our last episode, we looked at the West divisions in the AL and the NL, and today we're going to look at the Central divisions, beginning with the American League. Let's look at the results from last year. The Detroit Tigers won the division with a record of 88-74. The White Sox finished second with a record of 85-77. In third place, the Royals were 72-90. Cleveland was fourth with a record of 68-94. And in the basement was the Minnesota Twins with a record of 66-96. And just from the conversations that we've had, I think we all eliminated Minnesota from any type of contention in the division this year. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. I even went as far to say as that they've got a chance to potentially be as bad as the Houston Astros. So there's holes all over this team. Obviously, they still have Justin Morneau and Joe Mauer, but I don't think at this point in their careers and also how they've done the past couple of seasons that you can really count on them either for production or health. I think it was a big mistake to keep Joe Mauer as a catcher. I think he could have been one of the best hitters of his generation if they moved him either to first base or as a designated hitter. And then with Justin Morneau and his concussion problems, I think he should have been the everyday DH. So I don't see much happening with Minnesota. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they're going to win any games. Well, they'll win games, obviously, but not very many. Joe Mauer is definitely the best player on that team, followed by Morneau. I agree with you in the sense that they shouldn't have left him as a catcher and moved him to first base. However, he's shown over the years. I mean, he hits 300 every year, and he's a guy that you can count on to get hits. But just, I mean, him in the lineup with everyone else, there's no one, you know, hitting in front of him and no one hitting behind him and Morneau. So it's going to be a tough season for them, but they've got a lot of young talent coming up as well, and their hopes are obviously set on another year.
I think we also agreed that Detroit is going to win the division. They only won 88 games last year. That's not a lot of wins to take the division. What do you guys think? I mean, would 88 wins win this division again this season?
I think 88 wins actually would win the division, but I don't think there's any chance that Detroit is only going to win 88 games. Like I've said with the Dodgers previously, I don't see any reason why this team shouldn't win 100 games. They put up a lot of runs last year. They've got Miguel Cabrera and Prince Fielder on the corners, and a lot of people haven't been talking about this, but Torii Hunter was a pretty nice pickup. He's had a couple of nice years with the Angels after being in Minnesota, and also they didn't have Victor Martinez all of last season, and he'll be their primary DH and fill in at first, but he's always been a guy who could hit. He just wasn't very well suited to be a catcher. So I think Detroit is the real deal.
Okay, and Mike, who do you like as the team to finish second in that division?
Well, just before I move on,
oh, sure.
I think the issue with the Tigers might be is their ability to close out games this year, because I know that they didn't re-sign Jose Valverde, and even though he was kind of declining last year, I don't think that Bruce Rondon, the rookie closer that they're trying to mold into that position, has been very successful this spring. So, I mean, there's a big question mark there. How they address that, I'm not entirely sure. But it's definitely something to look at moving
forward. You don't
think
Dotel or Benoit are good enough behind him if he fails, because I think overall they have a pretty good bullpen. I agree with you that Rondon is a big question mark. He's young. He's pretty raw. He throws the ball really hard, but he's had some bouts of wildness in the spring. But I think that any of those three guys behind him, either Phil Koch, Benoit, or Octavio Dotel, could potentially close. So
yeah,
I don't see
that.
It as being a huge problem. But
Mike, are you comfortable saying that they'll win the division?
Yeah, absolutely. I think their offensive firepower is going to outweigh their deficiencies in their bullpen, which, like Robin said, there's a lot of guys that can step into that role right away. So
I want to talk a little bit about the middle three teams in the division then, Cleveland, Kansas City, and Chicago. Mike, let's start with you. How do you feel about Chicago, the White Sox, this year?
I think they have the potential to probably finish second, but I think a lot of things are going to have to go right for them to finish second in the division. They've bounced around 80 to 88 wins the last few years. Their rotation features, two rookies, and they're both lefties, and Jose Quintana and Hector Santiago. They're both coming off strong rookie years. Their ace, going forward, is going to be Chris Sale for sure. I like the re-signing of Gavin Floyd. You know, keep a veteran around, and Jake Peavy's going to be an innings eater again. Their bullpen, Addison Reed is a rookie, 29 saves. Him and Nate Jones, actually both rookies last year, they moved past Jesse Crane and Thornton on the depth chart. Infield-wise, I think the Ramirez and Gordon Beckham combination's probably as good of a 1-2 punch as any, shortstop, second base combo in the AL. Konerko being a consistent performer every year for them. I think in the last 9 years, he's averaged 33 homers and 97 ribbies. Having Rios reinvent himself last year, he's proven he can be an all-star again. You know, he had 37 doubles last year, 25 homers, 23 stolen bags. I think what's going to hurt them is definitely Pierzynski leaving, and I don't think Tyler Flowers is going to be able to replace that production for them, but
Adam Dunn.
I know he strikes out a lot, but 41 homers, you can't argue with that. And Diaz could be that, he could be a five-tool guy for them in the outfield because he's a speedy power guy, and I could see him maybe accounting for the runs they lose for Pierzynski.
And Robin, can you see the Royals challenging for the second spot in the division?
I like the Royals to finish second for sure. Here's my problem with the White Sox. I really like their pitching staff a lot. I think Chris Sale is going to be an outstanding pitcher. As Mike was saying, the guys that they re-signed, Peavy and Floyd, really good moves. John Danks, as a third or fourth starter, will get the job done. But I'm not a fan of their lineup. Adam Dunn and Paul Konerko have been consistent performers, and maybe they've got a few good years left, but who really knows? And there's always the injury concerns with Konerko and Adam Dunn. Yeah, last year he bounced back, but he was pretty horrendous 2 years ago. I'm also not particularly sold on Beckham or Ramirez. I think those are guys who have been there for a while, and I don't think they've ever really developed. Gordon Beckham was talked about as a Howie Kendrick-type player when he came up, and he's nowhere near Kendrick, in my opinion at least. And, yeah, former J. Alex Rios, who knows what you're getting with him. So I think they have enough pitching to stay competitive, but I think that scoring runs for this team is going to be a big problem. The Royals, on the other hand, I sort of see the opposite problem for them. I don't think that they have enough pitching necessarily to stay up there with the Tigers, but I think they'll be able to overcome that with their offense. I like their two corner infielders, Eric Hosmer and Mike Moustakas. They'll be a year older, and more productive is what you're hoping. Billy Butler quietly hit 313 with 29 home runs and 107 RBIs last year. Most people probably haven't heard of this guy. And he has improved every year in the majors, so I don't see why he can't become a consistent 30 and 100 guy. I'm not necessarily saying, okay, he hit 313, so now he's going to hit 340 with 40 home runs or anything crazy like that. And their young shortstop, Alcides Escobar, also had a pretty nice year. I don't like James Shields as a number one pitcher, but if they can get guys like Wade Davis and Ervin Santana, who we were ragging on a couple of years ago, to be productive for them, I like their chances. I was actually just crunching some numbers for Santana yesterday, and he's actually had two seasons of 16 wins and one of 17, and in those three seasons, he had an ERA under 4. So he's hit and miss. I think moving to this ballpark should help him keep the ball in the park a bit. And I like their chances to finish second in the division.
So I just want to talk about the Cleveland Indians. They are actually very active in the offseason. Their first move, they fired Manny Acta at the end of last season, brought in Terry Francona, who was the manager for the Boston Red Sox in 2004 and 2007 when they won the World Series. They signed outfielder Michael Bourne, outfielder Nick Swisher. They brought in first baseman Mark Reynolds. They also picked up starting pitcher Brett Myers, who was with Houston and I believe the White Sox at the end of last year. Is that correct? And then to minor league deals, they signed Jason Giambi. Everyone knows that name.
Yeah, we watched some Moneyball on the bus back from Florida, so saw Giambi in his Oakland days.
He's 41, so I'm not sure how much he can give them. I think he played sparingly last year with the Rockies. They signed Scott Kazmir, a former Royal. And they also signed Daisuke Matsuzaka. That's kind of a hard name to pronounce. So they make some solid pickups there that might help them. And then they have a starting rotation of Ubaldo Jimenez, Justin Masterson, Brett Myers, as I mentioned, maybe Kazmir, and maybe Dice K. And then they have a decent closer with Chris Perez, who was an all-star the last two seasons. Should there be any optimism for Cleveland this season? I think maybe they could finish 500.
Yeah, I like their closer for sure. I think Masterson, he's a good sinker baller. He's definitely top of the rotation. Boston gave up on him a bit too early, I think. I think they're gonna finish third, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I like the additions of Swisher and Michael Bourne, even though they overpaid for Michael Bourne, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But they were pretty close to being a playoff team a few years ago, and the roster hasn't changed that much since then. For the worse, I mean, it's only gotten better. So I think the pitching additions along with the help in the outfield, they might actually challenge for second place. But I think they'll finish third or fourth.
And I just want to mention, the face of their franchise, Travis Hafner, his option wasn't picked up for the season. He ends up signing with the New York Yankees.
Yeah, my biggest problem with Cleveland is they're counting on guys who are in contract years, and I'm always weary of that. They've signed Michael Bourne, they signed Nick Swisher, they signed Mark Reynolds, and sure, those guys have been fairly productive, but you know that you're never going to get the same production following a contract year that you did from a guy in it. And I look at their starting rotation, and Justin Masterson is a good pitcher. He's not a number one starter. I'm not even sure if he's a number two starter. They made a great trade shipping Victor Martinez to Boston, and Martinez didn't even re-sign with Boston. But after that, there's huge question marks, in my opinion. Jimenez hasn't come close to the season he had a few years ago with the Rockies. Brett Myers hasn't been particularly good since he left Philadelphia, and the other guys in the rotation, who knows what you're really getting with them. So, I mean, I like the trade. I like that they traded Shin-Soo Chu, who they weren't going to be able to keep anyways. I think long-term Drew Stubbs will be a good player. He's still kind of raw. But I think too many things need to go right for Cleveland to be that competitive this year. I kind of look at them and see somewhere in the vicinity of 70 to 75 wins.
It's good that you mentioned the trade where Shin-Soo Chu went to the Reds. The Indians also got Trevor Bauer from the Diamondbacks in that trade. He was the third overall pick in 2011, and he may be in their starting rotation this season. I just wanted to ask you guys about Carlos Santana. Do you like him behind the plate?
I like him as a guitar player.
Yeah.
No, I do. I think he doesn't hit for, you know, he's not going to hit over 300, but he's going to give you a ton of power, and that's really all you can ask from your catcher. I think Santana is I think eventually they might move him to first base, but I mean, for the time being, he doesn't hurt you behind the plate at all. And he's a good, you know, defensive catcher as well. So
I like Santana. I like Mike said, he's never going to hit for a high average, but people that expect their catchers to hit 280 or above is not realistic at all. That's not what you're supposed to get out of your catcher position. I chalk up last year to, I mean, people say he had a bad year last year, and I'm just looking right now. He had 18 home runs and 76 RBIs.
Yeah.
So that's not really a down year to me. You'd like the average to improve a little bit, but I don't see why he can't take it to the next level, be a productive, really productive player.
When the RPM Roundtable returns, we're going to talk about the NFL free agency period. Welcome back to the RPM Roundtable podcast. I'm Paul, along with Robin and Mike. This week, the NFL free agency period kicked off on Tuesday at 4 p.m., and Mike is going to chip in with his top five transactions of the week.
Yeah, starting off with number five, Jermaine Bushrod, signed by the Chicago Bears. This is definitely a very big signing for them, because, as we know, Jay Cutler did not have much protection in the pocket, and Bushrod was Drew Brees' blindside protector in New Orleans for a number of years. So he's going to definitely steady up that pass offense for the Bears, which is much needed. Number four is Reggie Bush going to the Lions. They definitely needed a running game. You could tell in the past few years, or in the past 2 years, how that's definitely hurt them offensively. They haven't been able to open up much space for the pass, and having a guy like Reggie Bush to take over for Jahvid Best, who was initially their go-to guy, but because due to concussions, he's contemplating retirement. I think he's been trying to make a return, but hasn't been able to. So that's a big move for them. Number three is the San Francisco 49ers trade for Anquan Boldin. They got him for a sixth rounder from the Ravens. Interesting trade there, being that they were both the Super Bowl teams last year. The sixth rounder, I mean, in the NFL, a sixth rounder is still a pretty valuable pick. Last year, the Vikings got their Pro Bowl kicker, Blair Walsh, with their sixth round pick. But anytime you can pick up a receiver the quality of Anquan Boldin for a sixth rounder, you make that trade. Number two, Percy Harvin going to the Seahawks. This one kind of has a bit of a personal sting to it, because being a Vikings fan, losing somebody the caliber of Percy Harvin's never a good thing. However, I know there was some issues there on the team, and they had to move him. he didn't have much faith in quarterback Christian Ponder. So instead of him holding out for the entire training camp, the Vikings decided to move him. They received a first-round pick, mid-round pick in 2014, and I think a seventh rounder in this year's draft. So having a they have two picks now in the first round, and hopefully they might pick up a receiver in free agency to replace him or in the draft. And my number one, drum roll please, goes to Wes Welker, the Denver Broncos. Welker leaving the Patriots is a huge deal for them. I don't think Brady is happy at all, especially with the replacement they got for him, Danny Amendola, who is often injured. But I believe Amendola is a poor man's Wes Welker if he stays healthy. The trade for the Broncos is very positive because they have three guys now over the 1,000 yards receiving mark, in Eric Decker and Demaryius Thomas.
I just want to talk a little bit about the Welker Amendola situation. Welker signs with Denver, 2 years, $12 million total. Amendola gets 5 years, $31 million, with only $10 million guaranteed. So the guaranteed money isn't that much different. So what's the situation there with Welker leaving?
There was a bit of distaste towards the end of the year there. I think Brady's wife, Giselle, actually had some bad words for Welker for not making a catch.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and I mean, I ultimately don't think that's what caused it, but mostly the Patriots playing hardball with Welker, trying to talk him down on money, and then him, I guess, probably getting offended and walking.
When we come back, Robin is going to present the Man of the Week.
So in spring training action on Thursday afternoon, the Toronto Blue Jays defeated the New York Yankees 17-5. While March results are almost always meaningless, the New York pitching staff combined to post a fairly remarkable pitching line. They went 8 innings, gave up 13 hits, 17 runs, all of which were earned, with 10 walks and threw in 2 wild pitches for good measure. The defense behind them also committed 3 errors, which surprisingly didn't hurt them. Well, you likely haven't heard of Jose Ramirez, Adam Warren, Brandon Pinder, Preston Claiborne, Josh Spence, or Graham Stoneburner. We thought we'd draw your attention to them since you're not likely to see them in the big leagues anytime soon with this type of performance. On the bright side, they are your Men of the Week for March 15th.
So bad, I should be detention. I'm the man.
On Thursday night, last night, the Toronto Maple Leafs faced off against the Pittsburgh Penguins. They carried a 1-0 lead until about the 12:40 mark of the third period, and then ended up losing 3-1. And Mike, I'm just curious to hear what your thoughts are on about the final 10 minutes or so of that game.
Well, I mean, the Leafs played a good game for the most part. When you can hold the Pittsburgh Penguins offense to one goal in 52 minutes, that's pretty darn good. There was mental lapses, I guess you can say, that cost them the game. It seems like the same old thing with them is they get a good, you know, portion of a game in, and then all of a sudden the mental lapses come back to haunt them, and you know, they're running around in their own zone, and against the Penguins that's never a good thing to do. Crosby didn't score any goals, but you know, they have another guy on that line, Pascal Dupuis, potted 2 goals. Even though Crosby got the first star, but they just give him that because he's Crosby. I don't know why. But they're going to make you pay when you don't play a complete game, and that's what happened to the Leafs at the end of the game, unfortunately. I mean, this week was pretty important for them, and they need to definitely pick up some points on Saturday night. Whether they do or not will yet to be seen. What'd you think, Robin?
Well, like you said, I thought that they were in control of that game for the most part and were made to pay for not capitalizing on their chances. They're also not scoring at the same rate that they were a little bit earlier in the season, and I heard that Joffrey Leupel is about 7 to 10 days or so from returning to the lineup. And when I heard that, I was kind of looking at who was in last night's game. And honestly, for me, the guy who should be coming out is Nikolai Kuhlman. And I don't want to rag on this guy just because people are saying, oh, he should be traded or he shouldn't have been re-signed. And, you know, he's one of the whipping boys now that Luke Shen is gone. Obviously, you've got Dion Phaneuf and Phil Kessel at the top, which in itself is idiotic, but we're not going to get into that. But Kuhlman has 2 goals this year in 28 games, and that by itself would be a slump. But he was in an 80 whatever, however many games he played last year, slump. So to me, he's never going to score 30 goals again, and I don't think they re-signed him to score 30 goals. But 2 goals in 28 games isn't good enough for me, whether you're playing on the second line or the third line.
Okay, but I think he does everything right except score. So in a shutdown role, he's a guy I would want playing for me for sure, because he does all the little things that you don't notice because he's not scoring. And I think if you want to take a guy out of the lineup, why don't we take out one of the tough guys, Colton Orr or Fraser McLaren? I don't think there's a need for both of them on the team at once. I think when you see them they're not really adding anything offensively. And if we're talking about the Leafs' lack of scoring, why aren't we removing one of them?
Well, McLaren actually has more goals than Kuhlman.
Well, yeah.
But, I just think that, okay, fine, so you want to remove Orr or McLaren. I don't have a problem with that. But then would you put Kuhlman on the fourth line?
No, I would play him on the third line, I think, in a shutdown role. And I if it was up to me, I would move Kadri up the depth chart as well. I think, actually, by the looks of the lines today at practice, I think they're on their way to doing that. I think breaking up the Grabowski-Kuhlman combination is going to be better for both of them as well. They're kind of like attached to the hip, and I just don't think that that's right, especially when they haven't produced, like you said, at all the rate they were that 1 year, I think 2 years ago, when they were having career years.
So who's your second line center in this scenario?
Still Grabowski.
Grabowski with?
With probably Fratton and
Leupel?
I don't know if I would put Leupel in there. I would actually, Leupel or Van Riemsdyk, I would alternate them both between the first and second line.
Okay. Fair enough. I see your point on that. The Leafs haven't gone for the so-called traditional checkers on the third line. I mean, Kadri was doing that and scoring for a while. And yeah, Kuhlman's pretty good defensively and is fairly responsible, but it's awful to see him not being able to bag any goals, and he's also not even getting any chances, which is the toughest thing to see. You hear about goal scorers like Kessel going through slumps, and people talk about all the posts that he hit, and it's just a matter of time. But when I watch Nikolai Kuhlman play, the last thing that I'm thinking is, oh, it's just a matter of time before he starts scoring. So that's my biggest issue with him.
Earlier this week, there was a bit of a Twitter controversy caused by the agent for Jake Gardner. The agent's name is Ben Hankinson, and he sent out a tweet with basically the hashtag that said free Jake Gardner. Jake Gardner's currently playing for the Marlies of the AHL. That's the Leafs minor league affiliate. How did you guys interpret that statement, free Jake Gardner?
I think it's not helping Jake Gardner's case at all. And to have your agent go out there and, you know, the guy should immediately understand the market he's dealing with. The media here is going to swallow that up right away, and they're going to go crazy for it. The fact that he's, you know, tweeting this stuff out, I think, first of all, until Jake Gardner says something about it, and I think he's been downplaying it already. And, like, I mean, you can't take that with any value. The coaches aren't going to listen to it. If anything, they're going to listen less, because now it's like, no, we're not going to do what you're telling us to do. We're going to do what we want to do. So, yeah, I think his agent's kind of screwing him up a bit.
And sorry, just to be clear, when you said free Jake Gardner, did you take that to mean either call him up to the Leafs or trade him?
Definitely the call up, I think, rather than the latter. It's funny because immediately I thought, like, what does he need to be freed from? He's still playing in Toronto. It's not like they sent him down to, like, Omaha or something like that, you know. And I think Dallas Aikens, the coach of the Marlies, took a bit of offense to that as well, just in the sense that, you know, why do these players need to be freed from me? You know, am I not a good coach? Is this like a jail to them or something? So, yeah, it was kind of funny that way.
I totally agree with you. I think it was a completely stupid move by his agent. And as Randy Carlyle said in response to that, he hates Twitter and doesn't buy into anything written on there. And bottom line for me, too, everyone talks about how great Jake Gardner was, and you can sort of have the discussion about whether Gardner or Kessel was the Leafs' best player last year. Cody Franzen is doing what Jake Gardner did last year, but better than Jake Gardner did it last year. Cody Franzen has 17 points and is plus 10 in 25 games played this year and is on the first power play. So if you free Jake Gardner from the AHL, he's not on your first power play. He's not going to be playing the heavy-duty minutes because Franzen deserves those minutes. You look at a guy like Nazem Kadri, who had to go down to the AHL, and now look at him. Obviously, he's away from Ron Wilson, who made a number of bad decisions with him, and Kadri's even said, Carlisle's more open, he tells me what I need to work on, etc. But there's no reason to rush this guy up when either he's not ready or the team doesn't have a spot for him. I think it's completely stupid of his agent. He's not doing him any favors. And the other piece of that is that Gardner's now out of options, meaning if the Leafs decided that he wasn't good enough to be in their lineup, he would have to sit in the press box, because if you tried to send him down through waivers, there would be 29 waiver claims put in.
Yeah.
There's no question.
And I think a team that's struggling defensively doesn't need an offensively minded defenseman right now.
Right.
They've got one sitting up in the press box, and he actually played last night and did a pretty good job. I kind of like to see him in there over Koska. That was kind of a nice change.
Yeah, he was not bad. As you said, they'd given up 29 goals in their previous seven games last night.
And the best thing I noticed actually about Lyles is that you didn't really notice him, which is almost a good thing in that sense, because you didn't see him making the big glaring mistakes. So that was, I think he'll remain in the lineup for the next game.
Yeah, he was good. He was definitely good.
Prior to the game against the Penguins yesterday, the Leafs made, I'd say, a minor trade. They traded center Nicholas Deschamps to the Washington Capitals for defenseman Kevin Marshall. And I know, Robin, you were, I guess, somewhat amused by that trade. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, it's a funny trade, actually. So, as you said, Nicholas Deschamps was playing for the Marlies, and he was originally acquired by the Leafs when they traded Luca Caputi who they had acquired for trading Alexei Ponikarovsky. So I was just wondering who the Leafs are going to get for Kevin Marshall when they trade him. The other interesting part about that is that Marshall was actually selected in the second round in 2007, two picks ahead of PK Subban and 20 picks ahead of Wayne Simmonds. So he's now joining his third professional organization. He's a big, strong defenseman, gets lots of penalty minutes. He only has 34 career goals in his nine professional seasons. And, I mean, this is just a depth move. There's a logjam of defensemen both on the Leafs and on the Marlies. And even with Deschamps, there were guys like Joe Colburn, Carter Ashton, Ryan Hamilton who were going to get called up before. So this is a non-story almost. I just wanted to bring that interesting perspective about a guy who was traded for a guy who was traded.
Ladies and gentlemen, cover your ears, hide your women and kids. It's time for Robin's rant, and I mean rant.
So I'm just going to start off by reading some spring numbers to you. Adam Lind is hitting .419 in 31 at-bats with one home run, five RBIs, and five walks to only four strikeouts. Ricky Romero, on the other hand, has a 6.5 ERA in three starts, giving up four runs. Yeah, okay, you get it. The point is, one of them is struggling, one of them has success. And people have different responses based on what their preconceived notions are about these guys. In Lynn's case, oh, it's just spring. He's been written off as nothing more than a placeholder until someone like Justin Morneau or whoever else comes. And Ricky Romero, oh, see, it isn't any better than last year. And that's completely ridiculous. How can spring numbers indicate one thing for one guy and something totally different for another guy? I also think this talk about J.A. Happ replacing Romero based on that is totally insane. I'm going to read off some numbers and you see if you can identify who put these up. 5-17 with a 5.80 ERA. Oh, Zach Greinke, who just signed a six-year, $159 million contract with the Dodgers. 5-8 with a 6.29 ERA. Yeah, that would be Cliff Lee. 10-15 with a 5.18 ERA. Tim Lincecum, NL Cy Young winner last year. And how about this one? 11-17, leading the AL in losses with a 4.84 ERA. Yeah, that would be Mr. Justin Verlander. So yeah, was Ricky Romero's 9-14 2012 good? No, it wasn't. But previously, he had won 13, 14, and 15 games respectively. His ERA went down three quarters of a run, and Jay Happ has had one season better than Ricky's previous. So let this guy pitch, see how he does, and at the end of May or by the All-Star break, if he's still struggling, yeah, that's the time to have the conversation. But right now, Ricky Romero is and should be a Jays starter.
Yeah! Kick it! Thank you for listening to the RPM Roundtable Podcast.